You know, many years ago, I happened to be building a small extension and at a house near our home. And we were digging down the foundations and clearing out the actual area. It was an area, it wasn't that huge, what was it, about 12 foot by 12 foot, something like that. And digging out the foundations for the footings. And we came across this structure. It was a structure of two pieces of slate, in it, like a V, an upturned V, with this flat piece of slate underneath it. And it was quite tall, it was about 2 or 3 feet tall, and it was fairly deep down. And the building inspector came out and he says, "Oh, it's a Roman drain." And this thing was pristine. This thing was completely pristine. You could actually, we pulled it out and we looked inside and we could look right the way down. It was clean, completely clear. The water from the road, which was just outside, was obviously running away through this drain, 2,000 years old. 2,000 years old. And the Romans had made it, and even to this day, as I say, 2,000 years later, it was still working and working well until we went and blocked it all off and rerouted it round the outside. Now, the plastic pipe we put round undoubtedly is not going to last another 2,000 years, but apparently it does at least take the water around there. But Rome did make some enormous buildings, enormous aqueducts. There's an aqueduct down in, I think it's in Spain, which is about half a mile long across this huge valley. And it's all built with dry stone walls. All the stones are all fitted into each other. It's withstood earthquakes. And it's still standing, and it's still drawing, having water actually going over the top of it. They're using it as a supplemental supply for the city. But Rome itself fell. They had some fantastic works, and yet Rome itself fell. And as Mr. Henderson was bringing out with the three areas that he discussed, the undermining of the dignity and the sanctuary of the family was one major, major area that was the problem. The higher taxes and spending of public money and free bread and circuses for the people, that also was a major problem, the taxation, and the mad craze for pleasure and sports. But the other two areas that Gibbon actually brings out are the area of the building up of armaments when the real enemy was actually within, and associated with that, which breaks it up into another point, the decay of personal responsibility. So it was a case of trusting the armaments and all the outside facing weaponry that they had and the things that they had in that area, when it was the enemy within and the decay of personal responsibility which was the real problem. And finally, the decay of religion. Because when you get into the 400 AD, which is the time that Rome actually fell, eventually, you're looking at the Catholic Church coming along, and it was, Gibbon was not popular in Catholic circles. He wasn't, because he pointed as one of the downfalls of Rome was the rise of the Catholic Church. That was one of the major problems. Because it was a decay of religion fading into mere form and losing the power to guide people. It was the form that was there, as opposed to what was there originally within Rome, even in Republican Rome, as it actually came in the pagan form of Rome. So what I want to do today is I want to cover those three points: the building up of armaments when the enemy was within, the decay of the personal responsibility, and the decay of religion and going into merely a form. Because I want to stress in doing that is that to have an empire, if anybody wants to have an empire, there's one thing that is absolutely essential. Those that make up the country, those that make up the country that is going to have an empire, must have a bigger picture than themselves. That is a heart core of the problem. So character, away from self, is a key ingredient. Now that has a great deal to tell us about the problems within our societies today. It also has a great deal to tell us about what we in the church also have got to make sure we hold on to today. Because you can see that anciently in Rome and the Greece and the Babylon and various other civilizations. You can see the problem today in the UK and the USA. And you can also see the problems within God's church and also the solutions within the church for the tomorrow, the world tomorrow. But this vital role that we all must actually play in the bigger picture is an essential role, is the fact that what destroys empires is a phrase like, it's all about me. It's all about me, you know, because I'm worth it. that, don't you see those advertisements? It's because you're worth it. And the thing is, today, we're going to have a greater fall, because what we're looking at this time is we've got technology. Technology that also gives us the armaments that we've got today. Technology that speeds up the communications that we've got today, so all of these problems can go and whiz around the world at an accelerated rate. Technology that also prevents the actual existence of character from having quite the effect in the theatre of warfare. So this society can actually degenerate further and further down before it eventually collapses. So all of these things are going to roll up into the tribulation. And that's why it's going to be called the greatest time of trouble that's ever been. Because we're living in this time when many will rush to and fro on the earth, and knowledge shall greatly increase. And these things will compound with these areas of selfishness that will bring down empires, but it will finally bring down the entire Western world, the entire Eastern world, all of mankind will come crashing down. The entire civilization will come crashing down around our ears, compounded by the time that we're actually living in. So let's have a look at this first area. The fact that the build-up of arms is there, and yet the real enemy is within. You know, in ancient Rome, let me read this section. It says, for hundreds of years, the Roman Empire possessed the most powerful, awe-inspiring, and disciplined military force in history. At its greatest peak, the Roman Empire was surrounded by a ring of military fortresses in Britain, on the Rhine, the Danube, the Euphrates, in Arabia, Egypt, and Africa. This is from a book called Rome by Rost... I can't even pronounce his name, but anyway, by somebody, beginning with R. But he says, to support this ever-growing military machine with all the vast requirements for more fortresses, weapons of every kind, manpower and food, it required heavy financial burdens on the government and the populace, and therefore the taxes, as we've brought out already in the preceding sermon, were high to support that. And it says, from Diocletian onwards, vast armament factories manufactured all arms required for the insatiable military forces. And that's happening today. Vast armaments, armament factories are there. It says there were 15 factories in the Eastern Empire for the production of shields and arms. Damascus, Antioch, Edessa, Nicomedia, Sardis, Thessalonica and others. Other cities were centres for production of heavy cavalry armour. The Western Empire had its vast military industrial complexes too. It says there were shield works at Aquincum, Carntum. There's a whole list of several of these factories, these areas. Arrow factories at Concordia and Matisco, a bow factory at Tictum, a breastplate works at Mantua, sword factories at Lucia and Rima, and for the various the ballistae, the catapult artillery. And these were all manufactured. There was a huge manufacturing process within ancient Rome. This is by Jones, called The Later Roman Empire, on page 834. So they had their armaments, and they had their industry producing this, and it became more and more and more pronounced within the Roman Empire, trying to get the armaments. And they're looking for the armaments, the build-up of arms, where this real enemy was actually within, was the thing that was one of the things that Gibbon highlights as a major problem within the ancient Roman Empire. When we come into today, if we take just one country, and it's a major country today, and that is the United States, the amount the United States spent in 2008 on armaments, or military spending, was $711 billion. $711 billion. Now Britain spent $55.4 billion. You add those two together and you've got half, over half, the entire expenditure of the world on armaments. Just Britain and America, nobody else. The US military spending accounts for 48%, or almost half the world's total military spending. US military spending is more than the next 46 highest spending countries in the world combined. The next 46 countries combined, America spends more. Now, where is America looking for its strength? It's looking where it's putting you, where put your money where your mouth is. That's where it's looking for its strength. The US military spending is 5.8 times more than China, 10.2 times more than Russia. This is times now. 10.2 times more than Russia. 98.6 times more than Iran. And Iran is the one that they're fearing. So we see clearly within our modern world that our countries are looking for the arms to protect them. And you turn over to Isaiah 30. In Isaiah chapter 30, we find God's view of the situation and God's prophecy for the future which is very, very soon to actually come on this earth. Because here in Isaiah 30, notice right at the very end, verse 33, for Tophet is ordained of old. Yes, for the king it is prepared. Now, Tophet is an area in the valley of Hinnom. That is hell, Hades. Gehenna, rather, sorry. It is the area that is the valley of Hinnom. And Tophet was actually where they had child sacrifices years gone by. And it's somewhere where it seems that Christ will actually have a chasm opened in the earth, in which where the beast and the false prophet are going to be thrown. And as it says here, yes, for the king it is prepared, for the beast, in other words, it's prepared. He that has made it deep and large, the pile thereof is fire and much wood, the breath of the eternal, like a stream of brimstone, does kindle it. And it says then, woe unto them that go down to Egypt for help, and stay, they put their trust, they rely on horses, and their trust on chariots, because they're many, and in horsemen, because they're very strong, but they don't look upon the Holy One of Israel, neither do they seek the Eternal. If we look in verse 3, now the Egyptians are men, and they're not God, and their horses are flesh, and they're not spirit. When the Eternal will stretch out his hand, both he that helps shall fall, and he that is helped shall fall down, and they shall all fall together. And verse 8, and then shall the Assyrian fall with the sword. This individual who is eventually going to be destroyed, he's going to be thrown into the lake of fire by the angel under God's direction. In the valley of Hinnom, in Tophet. Not of a mighty man, and the sword not of a mean man shall devour him, but he shall flee from the sword, and his young men shall be discomfited. And he shall pass over his strongholds for fear, and the princes shall be afraid of the ensign, says the Eternal, whose fire is in Zion, his furnace in Jerusalem. Because the valley of Tophet, the valley of Hinnom, is actually just south of Zion, the place where Zion is. So it certainly is going to be a time when the build-up of arms and all the armaments that we're currently seeing are going to come to its conclusion. And the armaments that we're seeing will actually come to its conclusion as far as Assyria is concerned as well. And who is likened to the beast that make their war against him? And he'll come to his end. Deuteronomy 31. Here in Deuteronomy chapter 31, right at the very end, it's an introduction into the Song of Moses. Now the Song of Moses is dealing with the history of Israel from that time, right the way through, right into the end time. And it concentrates, if you like, at the very end time. But here, in verse 29 of Deuteronomy 31, it says, for I know that after my death, this is Moses talking now, you will utterly corrupt yourselves and turn aside from the way which I have commanded you. The Torah is the way, the direction, the way, the law of God, the Torah is the way, the direction you're looking for. And evil will befall you in the latter days. So he's talking about Israel in the latter days. He's not talking about Israel then. He's looking down into the future. Because you do evil in the sight of the Eternal to provoke him to anger through the work of your hands. And Moses spoke in the ears of the congregation of Israel the words of this song until they were ended. Give ear, O heavens, and I'll speak. Listen, O earth, the words of my mouth. And he then starts the actual song of Moses, which incidentally, if you go into Revelation, you'll find it is talking about the them learning the song of, or singing the song of Moses and the Lamb at that time when these things are going to be fulfilled. But notice in verse 25 what is being said here in this song of Moses. It says, the sword without, terror within, shall destroy both the young man and the virgin, the suckling and the man of grey hairs. And I said I would scatter them into the corners, I would make the remembrance of them to cease from among men. Were it not that I feared the wrath of the enemy, lest their adversaries should behave themselves strangely, and lest they should say, our hand is high, and the Eternal has not done all this. For they are a nation void of counsel. This is Israel. And this is the problem. Here is Israel. Here is America alone, spending $711 billion on armaments and putting their trust in it. It says, for they're a nation void of counsel, neither is there any understanding in them. Oh, that they were wise, that they understood this, that they would consider their latter end. And what we're looking at today is a latter end, the latter end of our countries. How should one chase 1,000? And you go back into history, and this is where you find innumerable odds against Britain and America at times, and battles that have been won. How does that work? How does it work? Your records of the Zulus running in terror because there are white horses in the hills. How should one chase 1,000, and two put 10,000 to flight, except their rock had sold them, and the Eternal had shut them up? You'll go back into history and recognize that no, there was a hand there. There was something there. It wasn't just an arbitrary thing. And yet what is happening today? Because when we're looking at the build-up of arms, when we're looking at the way in which the society is going, here's an article that appeared in the Telegraph yesterday, I think it was. It says, a party like it's 1899, Cambridge Ball sparks controversy. A Cambridge college has found itself in the centre of controversy after choosing a colonial theme for this year's May Ball. Emmanuel College is holding its annual black tie event in celebration of the British Empire. And that went down like a lead balloon. Like a right lead balloon. Organisers promised guests a trip through the Indian Raj, Australia, the West Indies, the Hong Kong, and they celebrate the Victorian Commonwealth and all its decadences. Well, you know, you probably do in the Cambridge Ball. It says, disgruntled students have pointed out that 1899 saw the start of the Boer War and the first use of concentration camps by the British. Yeah, right. Yes, concentration camps where you get people and put them into a camp and concentrate. It was nothing like Auschwitz. It was not like Auschwitz. One critic, Joanna Belfoy, has set up the, quote, Emma Against the Empire group on Facebook, which calls for the name of the ball, sponsored by the Cambridge brand of John Lewis, Sri Lankan Airways and John Musk Brothers, to be changed to, quote, the Commonwealth Ball. She wrote, the British Empire oversaw countless atrocities, assumed an immense sense of cultural superiority, which is sustained to this day and destabilised dozens of developing governments. She needs to read her history again. She needs to read her history again. And it says here, oh, that they were wise and understood. How can one chase 1,000 and two put 10,000 to flight? You see, we've lost the understanding. We've lost the fact. It says she was backed by Lawrence Durring, who wrote, quote, the current theme implies a celebration of an unacceptable regime. A regime? It was in full support of the British people. Beyond that, however, it also nurtures the myth of white, upper-class, old-wealth Cambridge, and his devices are unnecessarily provocative. They've lost it. They've lost the heritage and the understanding of that heritage. And certainly, if you turn over the page, turn back a little bit into Deuteronomy 28, just back a couple of pages, we find here that one of the problems that we're going to have at the end time, one of the problems when we turn away from God and turn away from the ways of God, is as it says in verse 43, the stranger, in Deuteronomy 28, verse 43, the stranger that is within you shall get up above you very high, and you shall come down very low. You see, it's not just the build-up of arms, looking for arms to protect you. It's that the fact that the real enemy was actually within. Here is an article about, or actually a speech, by this individual I mentioned on the update, called Geert Wilders, the chairman of the Party of Freedom in the Netherlands, when he spoke New York, in the Hudson Institute. Says, the Europe you know is changing. You've probably seen the landmarks, the Eiffel Tower, Trafalgar Square, Rome's ancient buildings, and maybe the canals of Amsterdam. They're all still there, and they still look very much the same as they did 100 years ago. But in all these cities, sometimes a few blocks away from your tourist destination, there is another world. A world very few visitors see, and one that does not appear in your tourist guidebooks. It's a world of a parallel society created by Muslim mass migration. It says, all throughout Europe, a new reality is rising. Entire Muslim neighbourhoods, where very few indigenous people reside, are even seen. And if they are, they may regret it. This goes for the police as well. Now, the interesting point is that when you look at Rome and Italy, if you go down to Rome today and you look at the Italians and you look at the Italian government, you think, well, how could this possibly rule the world? How could this possibly be the kind of empire that the Rome had? And the answer is that these people that you're looking at in Italy today are not Romans. There is Roman blood there. There's some Roman blood left in the Italy today. But the Italians today are the slaves of the Romans that came in from the east predominantly. That's why it's Babylon the Great, because it came from Babylon to Samaria to Greece to Rome. And it was the flow of slaves that came across. And what you're looking in Italy today are not the ancient Romans. You're looking at the slaves that are left. And if this time went on for another 2,000 years here in the UK or in America today, what would we have? With the birth rates of the way they are, you'd have a Pakistani, Bangladesh, Indian mixture, you know, coffee-coloured mixture. That would be the nation. And people would come along and say, did these people rule the world? Did they have an empire? No, you're looking at the same thing as you see in ancient Rome today. And the same in the United States. You find exactly the same thing as well. You find the fact that you're looking at the Hispanic influence that is coming up from the South and coming into the United States today. So the enemy is from within. And it's interesting that when you see this enemy within, and the highlighting the way in which Geert Wilders highlights this enemy within, he highlights the Islamic threat that is there. But there's a genuine reason for the hatred of Islam that Islam has for the Western world. I want to read from Michael Savage's book called The Enemy Within. Now, this particular book, again, if any liberal who is listening to this, perhaps on the internet, will have probably a heart attack or something, me quoting Michael Savage, because he's exceedingly right-wing, exceedingly Republican in his views. I don't support everything that he has to say. But I thought that he summed this up very, very succinctly regarding the Muslim mind. He says, I find it stunning these Caesars of Hollywood fail to do any self-examination as they look for an American bogeyman to blame. You see, it's not our foreign policy the Arabic world hates. It's our social pollution that Muslim terrorists are rebelling against. Our social pollution. They do not want their daughters to become harlots. They don't want their wives to become Jezebels. They don't want their sons to be gangster rappers. They don't want their nephews to become nieces. Again, he's rather pointed, to say the least. Hear me, it's the filth, the pollution of our entertainment industry, wafting across the world that they despise. It's not McDonald's, it's the porno violence, the decadence exported by Hollywood that enrages them. If you were a leader or an intellectual in the Muslim world, and you saw the debauchery promulgated by the West, whether it be from the US, France, Sweden, Germany, and you saw your young people gravitating towards the filth that's pumped out over your airways, what would you do? You wonder why we've got problems? That's where you go for the problems. The problems are in the West. There's your destruction. Frankly, you would support Al-Qaeda or any organisation that want to stop that flood of pollution from entering your country. Why else do you think that Barbie dolls have been banned in Saudi Arabia? Before Barbie and what was the other one? Cindy and Barbie. Before these two dolls came along, what did kids play with? They played with babies. Baby dolls. The dolls mimicking babies, nurturing and so on. But along comes Barbie, along comes Cindy, and what do they have? They are vicarious dolls. A totally, totally different mindset. Why do you think Barbie dolls have been banned in Saudi Arabia for 10 years? In a culture where women must be covered from head to toe, Barbie is a threat to morality. That's the naked truth. Sheikh Abdullah Al-Mardas, a preacher of a mosque in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, is concerned about Barbie's developed body, about her revealing clothes. He explained, "It is no problem that little girls play with dolls, but these revealing clothes will be imprinted in their minds and they'll refuse to wear the clothes we are used to as Muslims." If you want to understand the war between Islam and the Western civilization and why we're so hated, I believe it almost boils down to one word, sex. You see, for a traditional Arab like Osama bin Laden, the jihad is as much a battle about sexual license as it is anything else. Consider these facts. Islam has very strict rules about sex. Look at the women in traditional Islamic countries are required to dress in the burqa, the head covering. The most extreme cases, the face covering. Why? Because they know that the power of a woman's beauty and the power of a woman's hair, which is the same reason Orthodox Jews wear wigs. And I don't know if you know that, but this day modern Orthodox Jewish women wear wigs because they're not to show their hair to anyone but their husband. The traditional Arab goes to great extremes to control issues of sex, seduction and modesty. That's why he has his women locked up tight inside a burqa. If you were him, you would want to put her in a pair of jeans and go, would you want it? If you were him, you wouldn't want her to put on a pair of jeans and come home with a belly button ring, looking like a harlot from the Bible. He doesn't want a painted woman walking around the house with a socially STD that she's hiding from him. You know, he's very, very blunt. He's very, very blunt indeed. But do you see the point? The same is true about his daughter. She's dressed, clothed, hidden. He wants her to be married and have a family. He doesn't want her to become a disco slut. He doesn't want her to become a club hound. He sure doesn't want her to become a clip-haired, mean-faced lesbian and in so doing bring dishonour on the family name. Do you think that's far-fetched? Then you don't understand the Muslim mind. Pretty brutal, but it's pretty true, because the build-up of arms is outside, but the real enemy is within, and the enemy has a just grievance within, because he looks at the Western debauchery and he says, I want nothing to do with it, nothing whatsoever. But it's an enemy within the country. What about the decay in personal responsibility? You know, it's all about me because I'm worth it. You have this continually. Alexander Solzhenitsyn was actually addressing Harvard University graduating class in June 1978. And this is 1978 now, going back to 1978. And he said, a decline in courage may be the most striking feature an outsider notices in the West. Should one point out that from the most ancient times a decline in courage has been considered the beginning of the end. And Solzhenitsyn could see that within the Western world at that time in 78. And if you look at the actual decline in courage, this is coming from The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire by Edward Gibbon in chapter 2, in the West this is. He says, it was scarcely possible that the eyes of contemporaries should discover in the public felicity the latent causes of decay and corruption. This long peace and the uniform government of the Romans introduced a slow and secret poison into the vitals of the empire. The minds of men were gradually reduced to the same level. The fire of genius was extinguished, and even the military spirit evaporated. The natives of Europe were brave and robust, Spain, Gaul, Britain, Illyricum supplied the legions with excellent soldiers and constituted the real strength of the monarchy. Their personal valour remained, but they no longer possessed that public courage which is nourished by the love of independence, the sense of national honour, the presence of danger, the habit of command. They received laws and governors from the will of their sovereign, entrusted to their defence in a mercenary army. The posterity of their boldest leaders was contended with a rank of citizens and subjects. The most aspiring spirits resorted to the court or standard of emperors, and the deserted provinces, deprived of political strength or union, insensibly sunk into the languid indifference of private life. Not only is it the build-up of arms when the real enemy was within, but it's the decay in personal responsibility that is also associated with that as well. An article here I noticed, and this is coming from the Telegraph of a couple of weeks ago, about an Englishman's home is no longer his castle. And this particular article, it says, anyone who watched Little Dorrit on television recently will know of Dickens' obsession with the bailiffs that derive from the indebtedness of his father. But even the most rapacious bailiff in one of the novels did not have the power of his modern counterpart. You know, something has changed within society today. And this area of decay in personal responsibility, it's being reflected throughout society. And it is the personal nature and the fact that the Englishman's home was his castle. And every Englishman could go ahead and guarantee that, and was guaranteed that in law. But now it's not the case. It's being spread. You're trusting in the armaments and the resources of the council. You fall on hard times, you go and get your dole. You fall on more difficult times, you go to the National Health Service. And it is lacking these intrinsic character development and personal responsibility that they used to have in days gone by. But he says, even the most rapacious bailiff in one of his novels did not have the power of his modern counterpart. Neckett in Bleak House had to be invited in to serve his warrant or debt on Skimpole. This is because for centuries bailiffs were unable to forcibly enter a home under the common law right of citizens established in around 1300. Well, let's just read a little bit. You're in Deuteronomy. Go back to Deuteronomy 24, because here is what actually the source of this law that was actually made into the legal part of the English law in 1300 AD. And here in Deuteronomy 24, notice in verse 10, it says, when you lend your brother anything, you will not go into his house to fetch his pledge. You will stand abroad, and the man to whom you have lent shall bring out the pledge abroad to you. That is a principle. And that principle was actually enshrined in English law. It says, it reaffirmed by many occasions by the courts, as in the judgment in 1604, from which the Englishman's castle concept derives, and by successive governments throughout history. In 1760, William Pitt the Elder made a famous declaration of this right, quote, the poorest man may in his cottage bid defiance to all the force of the crown. It may be frail, its roof may shake, the wind may blow through it. The rain may enter, the storms may enter, but the King of England may not enter. That was enshrined in law. Why? Because of what it says in Deuteronomy chapter 24. All his forces dare not cross the threshold of the ruined tenement. This right to refuse force entry held for centuries until the Labour government, with its cavalier disregard for personal privacy, came along. In 2004, it introduced the quote, Domestic Violence, Crime and Victims Bill, which contained the power to force entry in connection with unpaid fines imposed for criminal offences. This was a significant departure from the common law that merited a wider debate, yet it was included in a measure that on the face of it has absolutely nothing to do with bailiffs. It slid underneath. Why? Because there's a decay in personal responsibility. Personal responsibility has been lessened. This idea of an Englishman's home is his castle, no more. What the Englishman relies on is on the army to protect him, on the police force to protect him, on the fire service to look after his house, and on the council to look after him, on the look after his rubbish, and one thing after another, he's always looking on outside protection. And this enemy within, this decay of personal responsibility, is certainly part of that enemy within. If we turn back to Genesis chapter 2, Genesis chapter 2, this personal responsibility, I want you to notice what God actually told our forefathers, or our parents at this particular time. Because in Genesis chapter 2, verse 15, it says, "And the eternal God took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to dress it and to keep it." And that word keep is also found. So it's looking after, the personal responsibility extends to the garden, to the home, to whatever he's looking after. This is why our children should be encouraged to go ahead and look after whatever they have, and not just break it, not just trash the home. But Genesis, notice in chapter 4, if you turn over the page, Genesis 4 verse 9, "And the Eternal said to Cain, 'Where is Abel, your brother?' And he said, 'I don't know. Am I my brother's keeper?'" The word to dress and keep, and the word brother's keeper, they are the same word. It is keeping, it is to watch over, to look after. And this it extends, so it's not just the looking after the physical things that we have to look after. It is also the fact that we're looking after one another as well. And these two things go together. And therefore, when you get this decay in personal responsibility, both things are actually suffering. Another area that we find over in the New Testament, 2 Thessalonians 3. 2 Thessalonians 3. Again, we find this concept that if you fall into hard times, you don't look after yourself, you actually go and therefore have a handout. But here in 2 Thessalonians 3 and in verse 10 it says, "For even when we were with you, this we commanded you, that if any would not work, then neither should he eat. For we hear that there are some which walk around disorderly, working not at all, but are busybodies. And now those that are such we command and exhort by our Lord Jesus Christ, that with quietness they work and they eat their own bread." It is essential that we do, all of us, that we do work, that we, you know, get out, if we're retired even, we still have a garden, we still do something. And it is a principle. And certainly, if you look at what has happened in Africa, where aid has been put into Africa without personal responsibility, just given without anything to do, you get problems in the area. And we've seen that, you know, personally we've seen that, where the church has actually gone in and actually handed money out without personal responsibility being involved. It has caused problems rather than actually giving help and encouraging and getting people back on their feet by hard work and by effort and by industry. Certainly we need to bear the infirmities of the weak, but the weak also need to be encouraged to work. They need to make sure, as it says, you know, put in your notes Ephesians 4:28, where it talks about somebody who's stealing, steal no more, but then go out and work so you've got something with which to give, so you can therefore take, you're not taking all the time, you've got something that you're actually giving and returning into society. And this decay of personal responsibility, this is also part of that real enemy that is within. It is the real enemy of the population that is not of the same ethnic grouping that actually formed the empire, but it's and the reliance on the arms and the technology that we've got today, but it's also this decay in personal responsibility also erodes the actual nation within, and was certainly the part of the decline and the fall of the Roman Empire, and it's the decline and the fall of the West that we find today. And the final point, decay of religion into mere form, losing its power to guide people. Now, we've got all kinds of articles that we've seen recently. The latest one was this mother in a battle with a school over a Jesus ban. It says a primary school receptionist whose 5-year-old daughter was told off for talking about Jesus in class is facing the sack for seeking support from her church. Jenny Kane's daughter, Jasmine, had been overheard. Now, this is a five-year-old daughter, a five-year-old girl. Had been overheard by a teacher discussing heaven and God with a friend, and was pulled to one side and admonished. You can't have that in church. You can't go ahead and have kids actually talking about something using the G word. I mean, that's terrible. Mrs. Kane said that she sent a private email to 10 close friends from her church to ask for prayers for her daughter and her school where she works after she was called in and reprimanded. However, the message was passed to Gary Reed, the headmaster of Landscore Primary School, and the 38-year-old mother of two is now being investigated for professional misconduct for allegedly making claims against the school and the staff. In other words, because she gave some details to outside people and said, look, we need prayers, which all of us, basically on the fellowship group and on the internet, we do all the time. I wouldn't say there'll be a week goes by, but we don't have a prayer request for somebody that goes out. It is totally the way things should be done. But you see, you can do religion as long as you keep your mouth shut, or you're non-Christian. I mean, that also is another option for people to have. Another one, this nurse says, following overwhelming public support for Carolyn Petrie, the Christian nurse who was suspended after she offered to pray for an elderly patient, her employers have caved in and said that she could return to a job. The row over her treatment has reached the House of Commons, with Sir Patrick Cormack, the Tory MP for South Staffordshire, claiming that her case had highlighted the utter absurdities of political correctness. Although Mrs. Petrie was relieved her ordeal was over, fears have been raised that new rules could then lead to dismissal of any healthcare worker who tries to talk about their faith to others. A little notice document published by the Department of Health last month gives warning that the attempts by doctors and nurses to preach to other staff or patients will be treated as harassment or intimidation under disciplinary procedures. So you can go ahead and you can do religion, but you keep your mouth shut, you don't talk about it to anybody else. You get rid of it. So as far as the religion, what is the religion decayed into? It's decayed into mere form. It is something that you have, that you kind of do as something on the side, you do on a Sunday, but you don't ever let it go into your workplace. And yet the fact that these people work in the way they do, largely is probably because of their moral beliefs, that gives them the strength just on a carnal way. Another one, here is Gibbon's Rome itself, just to give you an understanding of what was happening. Again, it is coming from chapter 28 in his Decline and Fall in the West, and it's talking about the revival of polytheism. Now, this is why the Catholic Church didn't like Gibbon, and this is why they lambasted him. It says, the innumerable miracles of which the tombs of the martyrs were perpetual theatre revealed to the pious believer the actual state and constitution of the invisible world. In other words, they understood the invisible by what they saw in these miracles and things. It was evident that they enjoyed the lively, talking about these saints and martyrs, that they enjoyed the lively and active consciousness of their happiness, that they were capable of hearing and understanding the various petitions of the numerous votaries who in the same moment of time, but in the most distant parts of the world, invoked the name and assistance of Stephen or Martin. So they'd go along and they'd get these kind of icons of Martin's toenail clippings or something behind his veil, and they'd bow down to it and they'd ask for help in their trek across to this particular town and back, and they'd come back and they'd offer their grateful thanks to Martin after, I don't know who Martin, Saint Martin is, I've no idea. But it says, the sublime and simple theology of the primitive Christians was gradually corrupted, and the monarchy of heaven, already clouded by metaphysical subtleties, was degraded by the introduction of a popular mythology which tended to restore the reign of polytheism. So the Catholic Church came along and it then gave them their polytheistic religion, but it was a religion of mere form, and it had no power to guide people. He goes on, he says, the introduction of pagan ceremonies. He says, as the objects of religion were gradually reduced to the standard of the imagination, the rites and the ceremonies were introduced that seemed most powerfully to affect the senses of the vulgar. If, in the beginning of the 5th century, Tertullian or Latinus had been suddenly raised from the dead to assist in the festival of some popular saint or martyr, they would have gazed with astonishment and indignation on the profane spectacle that had succeeded to the pure and spiritual worship of a Christian congregation. As soon as the doors of the church were thrown open, they must have been offended by the smoke of incense, the perfume of flowers, the glare of lamps and tapers which diffused at noonday a gaudy, superfluous, and in their opinion, a sacrilegious light. You can see why the Catholics really loved him. It says, it must ingeniously be confessed that the ministers of the Catholic Church imitated the profane model which they were impatient to destroy. The most respectable bishops had persuaded themselves that the ignorant rustics would be more cheerfully renounce the superstitions of paganism if they found some resemblance, some compensation in the bosom of Christianity. The religion of Constantine achieved, in less than a century, the final conquest of the Roman Empire, but the victors themselves were insensibly subdued by the arts of their vanquished rivals. In other words, it was the paganism that came across from the East, with the slaves that then came into Rome, and all of that paganism that flowed in there, that they then went ahead and they incorporated into the Catholic Church, but it then drifted more and more and more and more towards that, the way which the Apostle John was talking against. As Mr. Henderson was talking about, if we turn over to 2 Timothy chapter 3, we're just over a few pages here, when this know that in the last days perilous times shall come, because men will be lovers of themselves, covetous, boasters, proud. And it goes on in verse 5, it says, having a form of godliness. Now, as it says, he saw this, Paul saw this in Rome at that time, and he saw the decline of the Roman Empire. Now Nero was the emperor at this time. He was well into the beginning stages of the decline, but it took all the way through until the 400s AD before it finally fell. But it took the actual Catholic Church and the power of the Catholic Church making it into a mere form and losing the power to guide people before the whole thing just fell around the ears. Having a form of godliness, but denying the power thereof, from such turn away. And you see very clearly what it talks about in Romans 1. The eternal power and Godhead, that they're without excuse. That should be forming the very basis. Now, in our own countries, this was not always the case. What we see today is certainly not the way it used to be at all. Here is a proclamation. This was during the Civil War. This was March the 30th, 1863. And it was actually a proclamation given by Lincoln during that Civil War, which lasted from 1861 to 1865. And in fact, actually it finished, I think it was actually finished after Lincoln was assassinated. But during that Civil War, the President of the United States made this proclamation. It says, whereas the Senate of the United States, devoutly recognizing the supreme authority and just government of Almighty God in all the affairs of men and of nations, has by a resolution requested the President to designate and set apart a day for national prayer and humiliation. Now that came from the Senate of the United States, endorsed by the President, because they were in a civil war. They were in a time which was giving them real cause for reflection as to what they were actually doing. And whereas it is the duty of nations as well as of men to own their dependence upon the overruling power of God, notice, they don't have the independence by themselves. It's not the strength of the American people that does it. It's by the overruling power of God to confess their sins and transgressions in humble sorrow, yet with assured hope that genuine repentance will lead to mercy and pardon, and to recognize the sublime truth announced in the Holy Scriptures and proven by all history, that those nations only are blessed whose God is the Lord. Would you see this coming out of the government today? Do you see the difference? And insomuch as we know that by his divine law, nations like individuals are subject to punishments and chastisements in this world, may we not justly fear for the awful calamity of civil war which now desolates the land, may be put as but a punishment inflicted upon us for our presumptuousness and our sins to the needful end of a national reformation as a whole people. We have been the recipients of the choicest bounties of heaven. We've been preserved these many years in peace and prosperity. We have grown in number, wealth and power, as no other nation has ever grown. But we have forgotten God. And again, just consider how far this government has fallen, and this people has fallen, when a primary school receptionist, whose five-year-old daughter happens to talk about heaven and God to a fellow student, is then reprimanded, and when she asks for prayers, is then dismissed. We have forgotten the gracious hand which preserved us in peace, and multiplied and enriched and strengthened us. We have vainly imagined in the deceitfulness of our hearts that all these blessings were produced by some superior wisdom and virtue of our own. Intoxicated with unbroken success, we have become too self-sufficient to feel the necessity of redeeming and preserving grace, too proud to pray to the God that made us. It behooves us then to humble ourselves before the offending power, to confess our national sins, and to pray for clemency and forgiveness. Now, therefore, in compliance with the request and fully concurring in the views of the Senate, I do by this my proclamation designate and set apart Thursday, the 30th day of April, 1863, as a day of national humiliation, fasting and prayer. Again, this is coming from the President. And I do hereby request all the people to abstain on that day from their ordinary secular pursuits and to unite at their several places of public worship and their respective homes in keeping the day holy to the Lord and devoted to the humble discharge of the religious duties proper on that solemn occasion. All this being done in sincerity and truth, let us then rest humbly in the hope authorized by the divine teachings that the united cry of the nation will be heard on high and answered with blessings no less than the pardon of our national sins and the restoration of our now divided and suffering country to its former happy condition of unity and peace, and signed by Abraham Lincoln. You know, we look at today and we see what is actually happening in the country, and we see the contrast between what was then and what we have today. And we see this decay of religion into a mere form, losing power to guide people. Let's just turn over to James. James chapter 1. James chapter 1. In James chapter 1, verse 22, it says, "You be doers of the word, not hearers only, deceiving yourselves. For if any is a hearer of the word and not a doer, he's like a man looking at himself in a glass and in a mirror. For he beholds himself, and he goes his way, and straightway forgets what manner of man he was. But whoever looks into the perfect law of liberty, and continues therein, not being a forgetful hearer, but a doer of the work." So notice it says, for he being a hearer of the word, it says, but a doer of the work coming from the word. He reads what it says in Scripture, and he applies it. It's not mere form. It's not a bunch of relics. It's coming out of the very word of God. "But a doer of the work, this man shall be blessed in his deed. If any man among you seem to be religious and doesn't bridle his tongue, he's deceiving his heart. This man's religion is vain, it's fruitless, it's worthless. Pure religion, undefiled before God and the Father, is this, to visit the fatherless and the widows in their affliction, to keep himself unspotted from the world." Now that needs to be read in the context of what I read in 2 Thessalonians 3, about if any doesn't work, neither should he eat. And that also applies, incidentally, to widows as well. Because if you, again, put in your notes, I haven't got time to turn there, but Acts 9, verse 39, it talks about Dorcas there, and about the things that she was making, and she was part of the widows that were there at that time. And if you want to again put in your notes 1 Timothy 5 verse 9, the widows of being over 60 were put into that group. They were assisted by the church, but they were assisted and they were organized and they were able to make things. They were able to work. That was all part of it. But it is that they do visit the fatherless and the widows in their affliction. Keep himself unspotted from the world. And not a forgetful hearer, but a doer of the work based on being hearing of the word. All those bits and pieces all gel together. And it fits in with what I just read here from Abraham Lincoln, that at that particular time they did have a view of life, which was far, far nearer the truth, far, far nearer the truth. So in covering those three points, as I basically mentioned before, I hope I have stressed that to have an empire, those that make up the country must have a bigger picture than self. We must have a bigger picture than self. That's what happened in the British Empire. That's what happened in the founding fathers of America. That's what happened in the beginning of Rome. It happened at the beginning of Alexander and his father, Philip, wasn't it? Philip of Macedon, and then Alexander, and the building of even the Greek Empire. And the destruction came when you came into the Athenian era, where you had the Athenian philosophers sitting around discussing life and metaphysics and everything else, but not tying in. It was, again, the decay of religion. It was mere form. It was losing power to guide people. They wanted to hear every new thing. Read what it says in Acts 17. So, to have an empire, we've got to make sure that we do have a bigger picture than self. Character is certainly a key. It's character away from self. It is towards that bigger picture. It is not all about me. It being all about me is what destroys empires. And it's also, we've got to make sure we understand that, it's what will destroy our usefulness in the church of God, ready for the kingdom of God.